So after we talked about Hitman on the Patreon episode this week,
yes,
I started thinking about it and I was like, do you think you could make a Hitman level that's a Turing complete state machine?
Whoa. Huh.
Because if you think about it, each of the people
is a transistor.
Is a switch.
Yeah.
And they're symbols. Uh-huh. Right?
Yeah.
Like if you kill the photographer, Helmut Kruger's loop starts working differently.
That's true.
So can you pass, and they can pass, characters can pass state from one to the other. So could you build a Hitman level that is a Turing complete state machine with the ability to do combinational logic, finite states, push down, all that stuff, and get to the point that you could actually do computation with murder?
Can I assume that the on-off state in this analogy is represented by alive and dead?
I mean, the problem with the on-off state is it's probably a one-way transition for most of the people.
A good point.
But there's always more people, is the way I'm thinking about it.
It's true. Yes.
Maybe it's not the named characters. Maybe it's like the janitor. So they just replace the old janitor with a new janitor. And then, you know, magic time.
Wouldn't you need, you probably need thousands of Agent 47s to actually power operations at more than like one every 20 minutes.
Oh, I don't think it would be a fast Turing complete machine. But the thing is, if you think about it, 47 is like the counter on the paper tape, right? So okay. 47 is going down past the symbols. And it maintains 47 knows what 47 knows, and 47 adjusts what happens based on the state of what 47 knows and the state of the characters he meets, and chooses to either kill or not kill on a state by state basis, tape by tape basis. I don't know. This might not even be possible.
If you were able to pull this feed off, what is the first problem or computation you would feed into your murder computer?
Oh, what is 6 times 7? That's it.
That's the last question, right?
Yeah, the only one that matters.
What else is there to do? Actually, yeah. There is one more thing to do.
Yes.
As soon as someone runs Doom on Hitman, then I will know that we have achieved our apotheosis as a species.
How does Doom display when it's running on Hitman? Is Doom
in blood?
Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad.
Brad, I'm real tired, man.
Yeah, what's going on?
Oh, look, it was late.
It's early.
I was up late last night.
It was late, and now it's early. I apologize. You're way more of a night owl than I am, and yet sometimes I'm like, hey, we need to record really early tomorrow because I've got a packed day.
You were up late last night, though.
Was I?
I don't know. You were like 10. That's late for you.
That's sort of late for me.
Yeah, look, I don't doubt that you're not awake at 10, but it's unusual that I see you online and posting at 10 because you have good mental / data hygiene habits more than me.
Say there are gradations of awake. Some of them allow for sending messages on Discord and some do not.
I went to bed at about 3 last night because I made some choices. Well, I finished my stream at like midnight.
I mean, you've got a slightly differently structured day than I do, let's say.
Look, naps are an important part of my days sometimes. I finished the stream. I like loaded all the dinner dishes in the dishwasher. And then I went out and Gina and I talked because like the only time we get to talk when there's not an 8-year-old around is at 2 o'clock in the morning. And we were talking for a long time and then we were like, oh, damn, it's 3 o'clock. So I was like, oh, I got to go record my fleet. And then I went to bed, went right to sleep.
I'm sorry, record your what?
Have you not been following? I've been doing a 3-part film series. By the time people hear this, it'll be gone forever. Fleet.
Telling me you're fleeting?
Do you not know? Do you not? Are you not up with the fleets? You're not down with the fleeting?
I've heard the term fleet.
Ooh,
I think I've avoided finding out what it means. It's Twitter.
It's
thing,
a 30
right?
second video on Twitter that's like an Instagram story that just disappears after 24 hours.
Ephemeral, but, I see.
Yeah, but you can download them, and there's like, look, there's it's a stupid thing, but I wanted to, you know, make so I did a fleet one day when I was brushing my teeth at 3 o'clock in the morning because I was hopeful that somebody the next morning would wake up, check Twitter, look at it, and be like, while they're brushing their teeth, they'd be like, oh, hey, Will did a fleet. What is this? And then they're brushing their teeth while they're watching me brush my teeth.
Yeah, they're like, oh, podcasters. They're just like us.
Yeah, exactly. And then the next day, I continued the mouth hygiene, the oral hygiene trilogy with some mouthwashing.
Just kind of. All right. And then the exciting conclusion to the trilogy, I hope, is that you find a way to both hold your phone and floss at the same time.
So I use a flosser stick. Do you not use one of those?
Oh, that's cheating.
That's so much better because I actually do it. If I have to put both of my mouth is small and my hands are enormous. So like
that is a
if
problem.
I have to put both hands in my mouth to floss, realistically, ooh, it doesn't happen enough.
Okay, it's too early for this mental imagery. should probably just move on to the topic. I was going to ask, do you make like copious use of night shift style, like, you know, color shift, color palette stuff at night? You have to, right? Surely if you're staying up that late.
Well, but I can't when I'm streaming because people complain that the colors on games are weird. If you turn that stuff on Windows,
but they're up late too. They should also be using.
Man, the world is a sphere, mm-hmm. and our time zones here, yes. where it's dark, are different than the time zones in what? Other areas. Yeah, it's shocking. What? But right now, somewhere else on Earth, it's like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Man, we should do an episode about that. What?
Look, I kind of don't want to admit this, but I'm going to. When we were talking to Doug the other day. And we were talking about bouncing signals around the sun. I suddenly, like in my head for the first time, I had a mental model of how I knew why it happened before. And I knew the effects, but I had never built the mental model of how the solar system worked and like why the constellations are different in the winter than in the summer. And yeah, anyway.
Orbital mechanics, man. They're important to think about.
Yeah.
Everybody should spend more time thinking about them.
Look, just play some Kerbal. That's all you need to do. Right. What are we talking about this week, Brad?
The hottest technology ooh. Of the
ultra wideband.
Wait, hang on.
AR.
I meant to Google
machine
this.
Machine learning.
I really meant to Google this so I could just throw it out without having to look this up. The hottest technology of the third century BC.
What?
Paper. Paper
like e-paper like little balls floating in liquid it's that you can charge and make lighter or darker
magazines, dude.
Oh, we're gonna talk on a magazine.
Yeah, right, that's why we're doing this largely. Oh. we're gonna talk about tech magazines of the past and our experience with them, reading them, I guess working on them, wishing you had worked on them in my case.
I just checked my navel.
What?
I was gazing at it.
Ah, okay. I mean, hopefully this is, I don't know if I'm comfortable saying this. Hopefully a lot of other people also want to gaze at your navel. Or this well, episode now, is going to be a wash.
Weird.
This episode is going to be a wash if they don't. But how did this come about? You found that little article about the founding of Future,
so
which is the publisher that you worked for.
A friend of mine sent that to me and was like, hey, this might make good podcast topic. And it's about Chris Anderson. Not Wired's Chris Anderson, who went on to make drones at 3D Robotics, but Future/TED Chris Anderson, who was my first boss's boss, maybe boss's boss's boss, when I started at Maximum PC and then left, well, kind of was run off by the investment bankers and went to found TED as a nonprofit in like 2001 or 2002.
Founding both Future and TED is like kind of a... A fairly impressive resume, I guess.
Look, I could tell you some stories, but the thing about Chris, I didn't know. I interacted with Chris maybe four times in the time I was there, but all of them were very positive interactions. And he had started Future in the UK as a publisher in the mid 90s or early 90s, I guess.
As
a bank loan.
Was it an Amstrad magazine or an Amiga magazine? I forget which.
It was an Amstrad.
And
he went to the bank and said, hey, I need 30,000 pounds to start this magazine. I think that there's an underserved market. And at the time in the UK, like magazines were a hot, computer magazines were a hot commodity because everybody was buying different computers. And unlike in the US where we were buying like NESs and Ataris that were basically just like cartridge eating machines where you could play games, in the UK, a lot of people were buying, you know, Amigas and Commodore 64s and then Amigas and you know, Spectrum ZXs and
TV
and,
computers.
Yeah. Like things that you could actually write code for.
But they all hooked up to TVs, right? Pretty much.
I think most of them use TVs as monitors. You could get a real monitor, but yeah, you could also plug in a TV.
Like all the, even in that era, all the computers I was exposed to in the States, I think required a monitor. I don't think any of the, like the Apple IIe's at my grade school could be hooked up to a TV. You know, like I've just always been fascinated by the idea of a full on computer that kind of hooks up like a console.
I think the Z Spectrum or something. There were a couple of computers that were just like state machines with switches and lights on the front.
Hang on. I feel like there's a ground rule we need to iron out here.
I know. I shouldn't have said Zed.
Are we doing Z or Zed on this episode?
Look, when it's a computer that I know only from talking to people from the UK in the 80s, I probably call it Zed because that's what they've always called
to
me.
That's fair.
But like I have no personal experience with any of those computers. And this was well before the time I knew Chris around 2000, like early 2000. And at that time, his interaction with them. He founded Future in the UK. He started a bunch of computer magazines. They became the brands that you know today in a lot of cases. And like that's a lineage that went forward for a really long time, including like magazines like Edge and we were talking in a different Discord with some friends about T3 a few weeks ago.
Yeah, which PC was Gamer.
PC Gamer in the US, bunch of other stuff. Video Game Player, I think, was one of theirs, but I could be wrong, at least in the UK. And then in the mid 90s, he came over to the US and founded Imagine as a licensor for the UK brands.
God, I completely. Is that going where I think it's going?
Oh, just wait. Yeah.
Completely forgot about that aspect of it. Wow. Yeah.
We're going to Paul Harvey this one. So he founded Imagine and like that included brands such as what was the unofficial PlayStation magazine? OPM? No, that was the official.
That was the official PlayStation magazine.
PC Gamer, PC Accelerator.
PC Accelerator.
Look, we don't need to talk about the problematic history of PC Accelerator in retrospect, but it was a different time back then and mistakes were made.
Might as well just, for people who never saw that magazine, that was very much the like games and girls magazine.
Well, there was
Maxim for gamers.
So, but the real story on that was they brought a UK lad magazine type magazine, which at that point were dominating the UK newsstand market. Take a topic that's of interest to early 20s men and add women to it. And that would sell really well unsurprisingly in a country where they're used to having topless women on the sixth page of their newspapers. He launched that. And one of the magazines that they launched in the early 90s was this magazine called .net. And it started out as the magazine for normal people who wanted to understand the internet because the internet was harder to get than a magazine at that point. And like there were articles, it was kind of like when you would go to Sam's or Costco here and you'd see the internet for dummies, which was basically just like a list of cool websites in book form and like how to use Slip and PPP maybe at the beginning. When I bought Internet for Dummies, it was like, here's what a web browser is. Here's what Usenet is. Here's what IRC is. Here's what email is. Here's some applications you can use to access those things. And then, you know, then the back two thirds of that book was, here's websites about finance. Here's websites about Star Wars. Here's websites. And it was just like a big listing of cool websites. .net. I never actually saw a copy of .net, but seems like that. So, okay. Imagine founded in 97, I think they started IGN.
Originally it was the Imagine Games Network, right?
The Imagine Games Network. Indeed.
I assume it no longer stands for that. I don't know.
I think that is not an acronym anymore. I think it's just an acronym. You know, it's like Exxon or whatever. Anyway.
Sure.
They spun that off in 99 as a standalone company.
I'm sorry to jump in here. They did Next Generation or no?
Next Gen was a future property, a U.S. future property.
Okay, that was the Future magazine that I read the most of by far. Like
that was, crown jewel right there.
Next Gen was a little highfalutin. I won't lie. It was...
Pinky's out, man.
They portrayed it as the thinking man's video game magazine for sure. But like, man, that paper stock was so good. Like that cover, I've never seen a magazine with a cover that thick and luxurious.
They led with matte covers before anybody else was doing matte finished covers.
Like, yeah, I had never seen it. It was like, well, dude, this is like a magazine from the future. What is this?
It was like Wired and Next Gen were the two magazines I remember having like matte finished covers well before anybody. Anyway, so Next Gen, they did Official Dreamcast. They did, I can't believe I can't remember what the PlayStation magazine was called. Poor Chris Slate.
Not the official one. I could.
Well, they did the official, the unofficial one. And then at some point Ziff lost the license for the official one and they picked it up and they converted the unofficial one into the official one.
Okay.
They did like the final years of Nintendo Power. They did Official Xbox Magazine. They did Games Radar is a future thing.
Was it PSM?
No.
No.
It was something that was a little thrashery. It was a little edgy.
I never really went for the platform specific magazine so much. I really liked was into the general interest stuff.
Well, I like read Nintendo Power and I worked next door to the OPM folks for years. So I had not OPM, Official Xbox Magazine folks for years. Like their offices were right next to ours. We had a nice relationship as a result of that. But, He founded Imagine. I started in 2000. And when I started, he basically like his deal was that he would come around when you were doing final covers or when you were during the cover approval process. And he would like talk to you, be like, hey, what is this about? You know, blah, 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 blah. Let's talk through this headline. And like you learned the secret of Chris is he's really good at cover. He was really good at covers. Like that was the whole future thing is we were good at covers because we wanted to do newsstand sales. Where everybody else kind of didn't give a shit about the newsstand. That was where a lot of our profit was. And we would talk through covers and he would ask what we were doing next month. And like that, we'd have a 20 or 30 minute conversation every month. And it was awesome. This article specifically talked about .NET magazine, which is such a weird thing to think about now.
Yeah, the way the article framed it was very much like, hey, look how weird it was to have a magazine about the web. And then once more people had access to websites, it's like, then they made a website about a magazine about the web. It was a weird cyclical thing.
Well, but also like it's hard to imagine now that there was a time. So eventually .NET became like a magazine for internet professionals, like people who were, you know, writing HTML and CSS code and stuff like that. But in the beginning, the idea of a magazine about the web, because there wasn't a website about the web, like it is really funny to me.
I get it. I mean, actually, I absolutely get it from experience because I wrote articles for my high school newspaper about websites at a time when I bet 98% probably of my high school class either didn't have internet access or didn't care about it. Like the school certainly didn't.
Did you get dunked in the, like, did you get swirlies and stuff because of your nerdiness?
Somehow I avoided that. Well, that was by the dude. I don't even get me started on. I was a senior. Excuse me. I was a senior by that point and
nobody messed with you.
No. It was more like the journalism class was very much the, like, let's fuck around for, you know, 3 weeks out of the month and then like cram out a newspaper as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Largely like, I'll put it this way. When I bought the Nintendo 64 came out during my senior year.
Uh-huh.
I brought it to class and we played quite a bit of Nintendo 64 in the journalism class.
You got the wave race. You got the
Mario.
Mario. Okay.
Pretty much it at the beginning. Okay. But anyway, whatever. I would be horrified to see those articles at this point because they were just about like the weird Squaresoft SNES JRPG websites I was checking out and stuff. But
well, so it's funny because like there was a period of time there when I was getting computer news and like what's going on in hardware world and all that stuff from these we've talked about them before, like the three big Quake news websites, which were mm-hmm. Blue News and Scaries, Quake Holio.
Yes, the Quake Holio.
and Redwood stomping ground.
Stomped, yeah.
But the for me, the magazines filled in some gaps and added more kind of texture to those conversations.
Well, also, I assume if you're anything like me, I mean, the magazines had been there for years and years before the web even came around, right? Like I was, I was reading video game magazines in the 80s, late 80s, and then PC magazines starting early to mid 90s. Like,
Yeah. So I was subscribing to probably PC World and PC Mag at that point.
Yeah.
But neither of them were particularly useful. They were all like corporate shit.
I was going to say they're very much the, like, first of all, I don't remember which one I read. I want to say it was PC World, but they're basically indistinguishable in my mind. They're kind of the same thing, right?
They were two. PC World was a little bit more cat. Like, I think Harry McCracken was at PC World by that point. And he was like, it was a more, they were focused on consumer market in a way that PC Mag kind of never was.
Okay. It was probably PC World that I hewed toward, but like those were very much the like khaki wearing beige box, like businessy.
They were very Computer Chronicle.
Let's review the spreadsheet software. And occasionally they would start reviewing graphics cards once those came into an existence and like mention a video game here and there.
Dude, their graphics cards reviews were terrible. Uh-oh. Like they gave the Voodoo 1 card, I can't remember who it was, but somebody gave the Voodoo 1 card a bad review.
Oh boy.
Because it didn't have a 2D component.
Oh,
and the pass through decreased 2D quality.
Well, that sucked. Like, I'm not going to lie. That was terrible. I didn't like that. But, the benefit was just
the point,
hard to give up. Yeah.
Right. So they launched .NET in the US and not to Paul Harvey again here, but .NET in the US launched with a small team, including my first boss at Future, John Phillips, who's now at IDG and working on Tech Hive and PC World and stuff like that. And he went on to be the executive editor of a magazine called Boot, which was the first computer magazine that I picked up that I was like, this is amazing. This thing is 96 pages and every page has something I'm interested in on it. Right. He had come from a place called Blast. I can't remember. It was a Creative Labs like custom publishing thing.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. And a friend of ours started his career there with John, one Jeff Gerstmann. So that's the story. And then when they shut down .NET failed pretty quickly in the US because they launched it right before Windows 95 came out and everybody got internet access. And like once you knew how to use Yahoo, you were probably okay on the stuff that .NET was going to tell you about as a consumer.
I was more of an AltaVista guy, but yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, look, the real secret was Metacrawler, where you could search Yahoo, AltaVista, Lycos all at the same time.
Look, did they have Jeeves or not?
I don't think Jeeves was around yet. Jeeves was later.
Really?
Yeah, Jeeves was like 98, 99.
I never actually used Ask Jeeves. I just think it's funny.
Jeeves he was less helpful than one would expect based on the marketing.
Yes. Very snooty.
So they shut down .NET and they split the team and half of the people went on to make Mac Addict, which was a Mac like enthusiast book. And half of the people went to Boot. And, Boot became Maximum PC, and that's when I started. I started reading Maximum Boot when it was like 6 or 8 issues in, I think, and Maximum PC from the beginning, and it had a profound effect on my life.
I mean, earlier in the decade, did you ever intend to work for a tech PC magazine? Because
I thought I was going to be a doctor. I was planning to go to med school.
Totally. I thought I was, I started out in computer science in school. Like I thought I was going to be a programmer or something. Like I certainly read plenty of magazines in that time, but I never thought I would actually get into the media.
It turns out if you understand something really well and can also write, that was an incredibly valuable skill at that period of time in the 90s and 2000s.
For sure. I don't know. Before we get into your career in paper publishing, I just think back a little more on that earlier period. Like I just like doing a mental tally of all the stuff I used to read. My computer, or my friend used to buy Computer Shopper all the time, which I feel like we have to talk about the phone book that was Computer Shopper.
It was
literally like the thickness of every issue was the thickness of a phone book.
Was it every month or was it like bi-monthly or quarterly or something?
That, I don't remember. You might be right that it was like a quarterly.
It was bi-monthly maybe or every other month. I might have it the other way. It might have been bi-monthly and been twice. Why is bi-monthly sometimes every other month and sometimes twice a month?
I was just looking that up recently.
Really?
I was just looking that up. I looked it up in the capacity of annual.
Yeah.
The context of my impression, the dictionary I was looking at, I think it was Oxford, did not come out and say it, but I think it's one of those things that just like,
it's like inflammable, sometimes meaning it doesn't burn and sometimes meaning it does burn.
Yes. It was very much just a language is fluid and this has come to mean exactly the opposite of what it's supposed to mean.
Well, irregardlessly, I think we should move on.
Cause what is it like? Semi-annual is twice a year. Biannual is every other year, technically.
Yes, but that is, I think, the correct way to do it.
But the definition of biannual in that dictionary was now that it can mean both twice a year and every other year, which is like,
Why when people use the language wrong, we have to yell at them.
I mean, I don't want to get into a debate about prescriptivism here, but there is fluidity of language that is useful, and then there is fluidity that is not, and that is very much the latter. I think when you are just muddying meaning, it is not necessarily a good kind of drift.
All I know is that the one time I typed irregardless into Twitter in like 2009, I got yelled at immediately by about a massive number of people at that point, probably 10.
Yeah.
So I've never used that word again until today.
And we're luck. I just Googled computer shopper and it was neither bi-monthly or semi-monthly. It was just monthly.
Okay.
But good to know. Like the thing was gigantic to be a monthly.
Well, and like, the thing about it was, it was one of those magazines you didn't buy because of the magazine. You bought it because of the ads.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
Because the ads in it were just as dense as they could cram a picture of hardware and a price and a name.
Yep.
Like it was a phone number or a website, maybe both. And then a spread often of like 50 or 60 pieces of hardware at varying prices. And like they advertise shipping rates there. I don't think I ever bought anything from a computer shopper. Same. Yeah.
It was very much the Sears catalog of your childhood of just, I'm going to get this to look at all the things I wish I could buy.
Yeah. Like, let's look at here's the thing, maybe people don't understand this now, but back then it was weird for there to be a case vendor name. Like a lot of the case vendors that you knew, like Computex, it doesn't matter. They would buy cases from Taiwan or Southeast Asia manufacturers, Southeast Asian manufacturers, and then they would put a new plastic front on it, a new beige plastic front, so it like looked a little bit cooler. And they'd be like, "We have a blah 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 Bob Jones model 65. It's $45. It comes with a 50-watt power supply, and you're good to go." And like you just went into the screwdriver shop in your town because shipping was expensive then, and you wouldn't pay to ship a case. You would just grab whichever weird like variant model your vendor had, your screwdriver shop had, and build yourself in that. And then Boot started reviewing cases, and computer shopper, then you started seeing ads for like super micro cases and like these big, huge towers and all this weird stuff. And it was from that like Cooler Master and Leon Lee and all those companies emerged as kind of like premium brands in this otherwise ultimately commoditized space.
Yep.
It was a weird time.
It was a weird time.
What kind of stuff did you look at, like memory and stuff? Were you that much in the weeds?
I think at the time that my friend was buying a bunch of computer shoppers and I was thumbing through them. I was not building stuff myself at that point. Mm-hmm. I think computer shopper was not great. It was they were more selling like integrated systems, right? Not necessarily components
components were in the back.
Okay.
Like there were also like your everything from like your Tiger Direct style. Here's a pre-made off the shelf parts. Like, and this, they would sell you a system that they told you like who made the motherboard and who made the hard drive and like all of that stuff, so that you like in a way, this was around the time Gateway started and let you do build to order PCs, which was a novelty too.
Sure.
Like that was a big deal when that company started. And that was the first time you kind of could do that if you weren't ordering 50 or 100 PCs at a time from somebody.
Sure. Yeah. I think I when I was looking at Computer Shopper, I was too young to have my own money for the most part. Or if I had any money, it went toward video games. So
yeah.
Not really buying much out of there. But I think around that same era was when I got into PC Gamer pretty heavy because of that demo CD.
So the demo CD was the other Chris Anderson innovation.
Yeah. So I read that and I didn't realize that in that article that was like a future thing, not just a PC Gamer thing, even though that was the only one I saw over here. I guess it sounds like even .NET adopted that model and was putting like web publishing software on their cover CD.
Dreamweaver, baby.
Right. But that was a, I would have to look up the dates to make sure. I feel like it was a 94-ish time frame that I was getting, maybe 95, I was getting PC Gamer with that CD.
So I know that in 96 they had started doing CDs.
Maybe
they might have
later.
Done floppies before that, because in the UK they did floppies and all sorts of other stuff. I feel like in the US floppies were harder because of the way our mail system, like in the UK they bundle crazy stuff with magazines in the UK. They still like model making magazines.
Okay.
You can subscribe to a like $100 a year model making magazine where you get like a little piece of a wooden, like a ship. And you get like one section of it a month over 2 year subscription.
Ooh, boy, that's a way to hook somebody.
Yeah. Like they do crazy stuff because it doesn't have to be flat. In the US, everything has to be flat.
Well, this is bad. I have now, in asking that question, ended up on an archive.org page with a bunch of PC Gamer CDs on it, demo CDs. That's not a rabbit hole I need to go down. But the reason I brought it up was like in a pre-internet context, like that cover CD was a massive engine of discoverability for me. Like there, you know, that was playing tons of games that, first of all, I never bought. Like I played the demo and was like, oh, that's cool. I don't need to play more of that.
That's
so
probably
like,
good. Yeah.
Right. Like that's why I have talked so lovingly over the years about the Magic Carpet demo, because I never bought the full game. I was like, this demo is pretty rad. I don't know that I'm going to go get Magic Carpet, but at least I know what it is now. But like, but you know, that was a primary way to get to play a bunch of games for $5 that you wouldn't have gotten to. Was it 10 really?
10.
Okay.
So that the innovation on the CD front is that you take
price.
A $5 magazine and slap a 10 cent piece of plastic on it and then sell it for $10 instead of $5 and 10 cents.
The manufacturing was nothing. Do you have any idea of the game makers were not paying to put the
sometimes
games
they
on
paid,
there?
But
or did they?
That probably happened later. In the beginning, the disc was a purely editorial process because they were really thrilled that people were making demos that they could. Like everybody, it worked for everybody because like pre broadband, really, there weren't a game demo that was 50 or 100 megs, especially like by 96, 97, the game demos were getting big.
Totally.
You know, and by the time they were shipping games on CDs, making a demo that would fit in a download chunk that didn't look bad was kind of difficult. So
yeah, for people who don't remember that era or were too young. I'm trying to remember the exact conversion. I think a 28.8 modem at best could do a megabyte about every 5 minutes.
Yeah, something like
if I'm not mistaken. So yeah,
and like realistically, you never got that.
Yes. So like something like the Doom shareware was like an overnight download if you could even keep your modem connected that long.
I spent the first music I downloaded from the internet were 128 bit per second MP3s of like a bootleg Dave Matthews concert, probably.
Oof.
Yeah, look, mistakes were made. But
did you ever download any MP2s?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
I had a handful of MP2s.
At some point I cleared out my music folder and just started from scratch about 10 years ago and re-ripped all my CDs and like left all of the horrible shit I downloaded from Napster and whatever else in the early 2000s. And there were MP2s in there for
sure. Nice.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, like that demo CD is like a formative memory, like a very like nostalgic kind of positive thing for me to look back on, because like I got to play so many games for, you know, I could not be buying $50 computer games all the time, but I could certainly scrape $10 together to check out whatever was on that CD. I should like look here.
Let me tell you,
Wing Commander 3. Go on.
Let me tell you the secret of the best job in the magazine industry in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
That was disc editor, it turns out.
Oh, that sounds so cool.
Because the disc editors would just sit around and play games, This is my perception as a writing editor.
Of course,
they would sit around and just to be clear, shout out to Ken. Ken did good work, but like Ken was also real fucking good at Quake because yeah, he had to test out those demos.
That's right.
And
I don't know which multi-skin pack to put on the demo disc this week. Yeah, or this
exactly.
Month.
Exactly. But then like also the future folks went kind of crazy. Like PC Gamer paid level designers multiple times to build, like they, I don't know if they sponsored it or just like paid some kid to build the levels, but they built like a bunch of those tiny scale, like huge kids' bedroom levels where you were like a little tiny Quake guy inside a giant, huge kid's bedroom, whatever.
The Level Lord Classic.
Yeah. And they would release those. So they do original levels. They did the Coconut Monkeys Tapestry of Injustice, which I think was a Gary Whitta jam. Mm-hmm. That was a Quake. That was a series of Quake 2 levels, and every single one of them was utter bullshit. Railgun Alley was my favorite because it would spawn all 10 players in the server, and the two people on either end would have to turn around and run to the far ends of the alley where there were railguns on either side. And whoever got to the first one won every time.
Just a draw situation, like a straight up Wild West duel situation.
Well, yeah, but the fun part about that was there were also six other people jammed in between them, and the map was one person wide, and the Quake 2 guy couldn't jump over other Quake 2 guys. So like the people in the middle were just, there was nothing they could do.
That's
they
were hosed. That's pretty good. I
fish
swear
in a barrel.
That's pretty good. I swear archive.org may be the best thing on the internet.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I am now looking at not only a download of the very first PC Gamer demo disc from December 1994, mm-hmm. but like scans of the slipcover so I can tell you everything that was on it. Mm-hmm. What do we got here? Wing Commander 3 was the marquee cover of the demo disc.
That one probably moved. That one probably actually moved. These would move the magazine.
Totally. Like
that was the amazing thing about them is if you got a good deal, and this is what the disc editors really did is it's the same thing that you did when you were at GameStop and you were negotiating exclusive stuff. They would. Yeah. Anyway,
I'm sorry to wear,
you know, GME, the internet's hottest stock.
Yes.
GameSpot. Sorry. It's okay. I was fine until last. Okay. I hadn't made the mistake in like 10 years until. Yeah.
Sorry. It'll never not irk veterans of that website to hear that. I'm sorry.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine.
I apologize unreservedly.
It was a constant uphill battle for us back then. There's a lot on here. Like Wing Commander 3, Blackthorn, Desert Strike, Jazz Jackrabbit, a bunch of custom Doom levels, Operation Body Count, Rise of the Robots.
Wow.
Star Crusader, Load Runner.
Load Runner?
Yeah. Load Runner, The Legend Returns. That was one of the later.
That was a terrible game.
That was a later one. Relentless. Relentless is great.
So
bug patches. They list bug patches as this was a way to get patches for games.
We would get drivers. We would do driver. Like we would stack the boot disc, which was maybe the best part of the best name. The only reason boot was a good name was that we had a boot disc every issue. It was not actually bootable for the most part, I guess.
It's false advertising.
Well, we did a Linux issue and I think we built a Linux front end that would install Slackware.
Oh no.
Or must've been Gentoo, but I don't think maybe Debian probably back then.
Yeah, that
maybe
might Red Hat. Be right.
It was probably Red Hat and Debian. If I think anyway,
I'm trying to remember which distros were even around back then. Why would you do that to people? I once downloaded all of Slackware overnight and put it on floppy disks and installed it to my Pentium 75. And boy, was that a mistake.
Yeah. It was hard to use back then.
Like, I mean, you know, back then, like no hardware was supported out of the box. So it's like, I'm sitting at this command prompt. I have no idea what to do now. Also, it's just a command prompt. There's no GUI. Also, there's no modem support, so I can't connect to the internet to find out what to do with this thing. I guess I'm going to stare at this command prompt for another hour and then format the hard drive and go back to Windows.
Well, and even if you had the internet, you wouldn't have been able to look anything up because you didn't have a browser.
Right. Right. It was it was a primordial era for Linux, for sure.
So NVIDIA would drop driver updates for us to put on.
That's
and 3DFX and those guys, ATI, yeah. And we would put all the latest, like you'd get a new issue of the magazine and have a bunch of shareware, like apps, a bunch of games, and then it would have drivers. like your video card and sound card drivers for the popular hardware.
I may have to DOSBox some of these demo CDs at some point.
Dude, I would totally get in and play some Hyperscape with you, or Hyper Slide, whatever the skating hockey cyber game was.
I wonder,
there was a bunch of weird stuff.
Oh, for sure.
What was that? I remember there was an early 3D game called G something where you were like a cop and you had to you flew around and they had colored lights on the city.
G Police
was it, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. God, man. I wonder if they have every demo CD they ever put out on here. Probably.
So I uploaded when before I left, we had a wall of magazines, and one of the things I did was upload PDFs of all of the issues that I had PDFs for, the pre-press PDFs, not the low res janky ones that usually published. And I sent them all up to archive to the folks at archive.org. So there's a complete run of Maximum PC from like 2000 to 2010 or whenever I left.
That's fantastic. I sincerely hope archive.org never goes away.
Me too. Archive.org is good stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, like, should we talk about your time working in that sphere? Like, what was that like?
You had magazine questions, is what you implied to me last night.
Well, I didn't want to get into my thing first, but I want to know what it was like to work in print, because like, once it was clear that I was going to write for money,
yeah,
I thought and hoped I was also going to end up in print, and then I didn't, and I was always very bitter about it. But I'll get into that later.
So, what do you want to know about?
I guess, building on what I just said, like, we both got in right around that inflection point where print started surrendering its primacy to online, right? But it took some time, and it was like kind of a weird process where like different people definitely had different opinions about what mattered more, whether like the magazines still had like a prestige value that if you were working in nascent online, you definitely did not. You were just sort of like the people were supposed to shut up and sit there and publish stuff every day instead of once a month. And like game publishers in my case, like, didn't necessarily like think very highly of online outlets at first.
That was back when Square like wouldn't talk to you guys because they thought you were all dirty pirates, right?
Right. Yes. Like if you at E3, you try to go get assets from them, they're like, unless you were print or broadcast, they were like, looked at you very funny. Like, who the fuck are you? Like, you don't need this, right?
Okay, get out of here.
Right.
So
I think there were cases where people at GameSpot literally had to just say, yeah, we're broadcast. Yes. Please give us your beta tape. We are absolutely broadcast media.
Look at these cameras. They're broadcast cameras.
Yeah, see, we're in TV. Just, we'll take that beta tape and not put it on a website.
So I started in 2000, in the middle of 2000 at Maximum PC. The first issue, I had written as a freelancer since the February 2000 issue, which probably I was working on in November or December of 1999. And my phone keeps going off. I'm sorry. And as a result, I had done a lot of writing, but I didn't really understand what the process of making a magazine was like until I went to work there in June of 2000. And the first issue I worked on was either the last or second to last issue that we sent like physical. We sent a physical copy of the magazine on film to the printer to be printed. Like, we didn't. After that, we went to PDFs, which our production department made, I think, by shooting and drum scanning,
basically like an old school physical process, I assume.
Well, so no, they were doing desktop publishing to make the pages.
Right. But the drum scanning, specifically sounds like some kind of optical or physical thing.
Yeah. So a drum scanner is, I never actually saw it working, but my understanding is a drum scanner is a thing that you hook you put the page on the facing out on, and then it spins it multiple times and does a whole bunch of passes until it collects enough pixels to accumulate like a 300 DPI plus image of the item.
That's wild.
As opposed to like a flatbed where the bar just moves once and that's what you get.
Yeah.
So I didn't work on that part of the magazine at this time. So this is a lot of me like inferring from listening to what was going on the other side, but they would make pages in Quark Express and then they would print them and then they would photograph those print pages in a dark room with a long lens on a camera from like 15 feet away. and build color separations out of that image.
Huh.
And then they would send those color separations to the printer, and that's how they would print the magazine.
Wow, that's a lot more steps than I would have thought.
Yeah, like you would have these things called blue lines that were the basic final proofs. So the editor, you know, in this case, John Phillips at that time, would go with the art director at the end of every month, and they would go down and look at all the pages that were ready to go and make sure that there weren't any errors. And like if you had a typo or something you had to fix, it was a huge pain in the ass, and it involved developing film and all sorts of stuff to get that changed. The 2 months later, we switched over to sending PDFs over the internet. The publisher got internet access. The printer got internet access is my recollection, but I could be wrong on that. And we would do high DPI PDFs and send those. And like a magazine, a full copy of the magazine was like, so 50. Well, the magazines were pretty big back then. So we're probably 75 pages because we had a lot of ads. And this is a thing people also didn't know. Like when the magazine got bigger, it was because there were more ads. So the base ratio of content pages to ad pages was usually 50-50 a future.
Yeah.
So we'd have a 96 page book and 48 pages of content and 48 pages of ads and then two covers. And if the ad team was like, hey, there would be a cutoff usually 10 days before the issue was ready to go, when we started laying out pages, where we had to say, okay, we can, at this point, we can either stretch the content out more by doing like more big picture spreads and stuff like that. Or we have some articles we can drop in, or we can do extra reviews or a longer how-to section or longer letters page or whatever. If you need to sell more ads, and they would say, hey, we have more ads coming, blah, 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 get ready for them.
So there had to be a specific ratio of content to ads. They weren't willing to just jam in multiple pages of ads without a break.
We would never go below 48 pages. So the smallest book size we could do was 96 pages.
I see.
We would never go below 48 pages of edit content.
Okay.
Sometimes as the magazine got bigger, just because like it's not like we staffed up in December when we had a 200 page book. You know, we had to figure out how to make 200 pages with the same 8 people that we had the whole rest of the time. I know your perception, Brad, as some sort of online chud.
Fucking slackers.
Is that we were just dicking around playing Quake 3 for 3 weeks a month, and then we jammed something out.
That is exactly, should we just get into it? That's exactly where this is going, because that was in fact my perception.
Look,
go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say this inimical attitude that our management was putting against us. They were pitting online against the print people, and they did that to oppress the workers, Brad.
Is that not organic? Because like, I mean, I came in late, like I said, and like there absolutely was animosity between print and online at the same company or in the same organizations.
Yes,
like,
we absolutely had that too.
There was absolutely like this battle of wills going on and some haughtiness and all that stuff. But like, yeah, I mostly wanted to ask, like, what was your working life like working on that magazine? Like, did it ebb and flow with the you know, deadline and needing to go to print? Or was it like a pretty steady year round? Like, because I know people who worked in print who were very much the former, and I'll get into that in a minute. But
so a normal month, like we did 13 issues a year. So we did one every 4 weeks, no matter what.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then we also did specials on top of that. So we did 2 to 4 special issues a year that were partly repurposed content, partly original stuff. So, and everybody contributed to everything. So it was a weird situation in that, like, there were more. Basically, the first week of every month was writing anything that was not time sensitive. So like advice columns, how to's, any of the features that were like how to oriented, stuff like that. And the next week was usually things like basically the first week of the month, we would plan the whole thing out and write anything that was not timely. Right. And that would happen over the first 2 weeks. Usually the last 2 weeks were reviews, because, you know, the print process, like, we were operating 6 months ahead, 6 weeks ahead usually. So like we would release an issue. It would take 2 weeks at the press and then 2 weeks in the mail. And we were looking at like anywhere from a 3 to 6 week lag based on how long it took mail to get there for people. So we wanted to get the hardware, the very newest hardware possible, and have the minimum time. And the shortest time that could be was about 2 weeks if everything like lined up right and you lived right next door to the printing printing plant. And we knew what the newsstand dates were, but we never had any idea what the shipping date was going to be, which was always a weird situation to be in. Cause like we were having to agree to embargoes and we were like, okay, here's the date we'll leave the printing press and here's the date we'll leave the distributors and everything after that, we don't know about.
God, dude, I cannot even imagine the moving target of navigating that whole process with publishers and people that are, yeah, embargoing the content and not knowing when you'll be able to post it. Cause like that, what, God, I never even thought about that. Like that is certainly an advantage that online had of like,
oh yeah,
all other things being equal, at least we know that the second this is fully ready to go, we can just click a button and it is live out there immediately. Like we never had to worry about like, God, is this review embargo going to miss our like deadline to the printer by one day and it's going to be a month late or what?
Well, I was going to say like often the last week of the month as the magazine is. So the last week of the month was production week. And that's when pages are being put in Quark and laid out. And like there's an editorial process where everybody looks because the cost of redoing that stuff is very high.
Yeah.
There's an editorial process where the assigning editor reads those pages. The managing editor reads those pages. The proofreader reads those pages. The editor and the original author and the editor reads those pages. And then the original author goes back and works with the assigning editor to like incorporate all the changes that were requested and additions and whatever. And it's important to note that stuff had already been edited and read once when it was a Word document. So like you did it multiple times. And you'd have to copy fit so that you'd cut stuff out. So that, you know, cause like the reviews were short, you had like 250 words on a full page review. And so on a huge month, the most I ever wrote, I think was probably 20,000 words.
Jeez, man.
Over those 4 weeks.
Yeah.
But like sometimes that would be, hey, and NVIDIA has a new video card coming out. We need you to come down to their headquarters, bring a test bed. And they're going to set you up in a conference room for 2 days where you get you jam the new video card in and you do all of your normal benchmarks and then you write the preview and you have literally the day. Like, I know what day I'm going to go in to get that to start doing those benchmarks. I know what day I'm going to get at the tech brief. I write the tech part. I go down and do the benchmarks and then we put it all together literally the day before the magazine has to be at the printer.
That's pretty hectic.
I mean, partly your perception is correct, but partly we also spent probably five or 10 times as much many person hours on every single thing that went into the print publication that you guys would have spent on the web. Because like our web process was like the writer writes it, the assigning editor looks at it, the online editor looks at it, and then somebody matches publish. And if there's comments about errors or something, then we go back and look at it and make a correction.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. A couple things jump out to me from what you just said, like 250 words for a review sounds paltry to the point of embarrassment to me because like at GameSpot, like 1,000-word review was short.
Yeah.
it's like, oh, you only had 1,000 words to say about this. We've got infinite space. Why don't you get into a little more detail? But on the other hand, so looking back on that process, when I hear like, oh, you only had to write 250 words, like that sounds like I can do that in 10 minutes, whatever. But the times, the few times that I have had to write something as comprehensive as a review in that short of space, it actually turned out to be incredibly difficult.
You have to really be strategic. Like I would much rather write 1,000 words any day than write 250 words.
Yeah.
That's like making a case for this product.
You can kind of let it all just hang out when you have that much space, just sort of ramble all over the place. Yeah. But like the kind of the economy of language and meaning that you have to work with in that short of space is pretty tough.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to mention is just like talking about the lead times on publish and having to have everything ready ahead of time. Like another nice thing we had in our favor was that the print people, at least for game reviews, the builds of games they were reviewing were so much earlier than what we had to work with. I mean, ideally we were reviewing boxed factory finished retail copies of games, but at least the debug builds we were getting were like basically final. Like granted, games were coming in way less hot back then, but
yeah,
like the print people were reviewing games 4 to 6 weeks early, like playing through games like 4 to 6 weeks earlier than we were. So like, who knows what state the review, like who knows what they were having to sort of gloss over or take into account as like, well, that'll probably be fixed. Like that sounds like such a messy process to me.
So one of the things I did when they made me editor of the magazine was we stopped reviewing early games. Mm-hmm. Like we would take them and we would look at them, but the review would be based on something that was closer to final. And if we lagged a month on reviews, we were fine with it because we only did like one or two game reviews a month.
Sure.
That was a problem. Reviewing getting the manufacturers to not send pre-final hardware was a real challenge, because like we wouldn't get like debug boards with like wires hanging off of them. Occasionally we did, but we knew like that was like we got debug board Voodoo 5-6000s or something.
Oh, wow.
And that was fucking awesome. But like, yeah, and literally what debug board in that era was like somebody had hand soldered wires jumping.
Oh my God.
Like pinouts on chips and transistors and capacitors and stuff like that.
That's incredible.
But it wasn't, we would never, so we, as a result of the print issue, we had really good guidelines on like what was allowed and what wasn't allowed in terms of early coverage. And we were really good at transmitting that information to the vendors because we'd done a lot and the price of failure was really high. And I know we have to wrap up, but and the like, we just didn't do NDAs. Like we didn't sign it. We had never. The only embargo we ever broke accidentally because of a CMS error was a Microsoft mouse exclusive that we had gotten. And we broke the embargo by like 2 days because somebody put the data in the date in CMS wrong, I think. But like I could go to NVIDIA or ATR or whatever and say like, look, we've never broken one of your embargoes. Our lawyers will not let us sign embargoes. So if you want to have this, if you want to have this coverage in the magazine, I can tell you when it will leave the factory. And I tell you when we think most people will have it, but I'm not signing any paper.
And you say you're okay with that or not, but that's it.
Yeah. If you want to be on the cover of the magazine, this is the deal.
Yeah.
And people would do it. Sure. But A, because they trust us, and B, because the online embargo would be 5 days before the earliest date it could leave the print house.
Right. And also, I mean, I assume there was also an aspect, I mean, I remember this back then, of like the people that ran those companies, granted, you know, at that time they were people that had been around in a pre-internet era, but they still had, they attached a certain prestige to magazines. Specifically, the thing we always heard was, you know, if you get the top slot on GameSpot, you're there for 24 hours tops.
Yeah.
If you get a magazine cover, you are on newsstands in airports for a month straight. And like, those are business executives walking through airports a lot, and seeing their product on the cover of a magazine over and over on a newsstand is like a big warm fuzzy for them.
I remember going to hardware OEMs and seeing framed covers or blow ups, even of right. covers
totally.
In offices and conference rooms and stuff. So people were stoked about that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It's nice to hear this slightly more realistic breakdown of what the like ups and downs and challenges of working in print were, because like my perspective on it, based on what the information I was getting, was that it just sounded like, you know, party time all the time.
Well, and like, I know our trade show experience, having gone from covering print to covering online trade shows.
Oh my God.
The trade show experience was dramatically different. And that's probably where a lot of this comes from, right?
Is like most, well, so I mean, real quick, I'll summarize. I know I've kind of talked about this before, but like I came up through the internet finding people on Usenet and IRC that it turned out worked in Games Press, right? Like mm-hmm. I didn't know that at the time when I was talking to them. They were just people there to chat about import Final Fantasy games or whatever. But like it turned out, oh my God, these people all work for game magazines. Holy shit. Like I'm talking to the people that are doing
their fames.
And the consistent impression I got from them about working on those magazines was that it was very much 3 weeks of roll into the office at noon, play some Quake, like play some of the review game you're playing, and then go drink at 5 or whatever. I am.
So that was my perception of the Games Press at Future at the time.
Okay.
Like I was doing the hardware stuff at 3 o'clock in the morning in the lab. Yes.
Right. So I might be embellishing a little bit here, but that was very much like the impression I got from talking to them while they were living that life was it was like 3 weeks of that. And then one like 90 hour week of, oh my God, we have to make an entire magazine in a week because we haven't done shit.
I look, there were definitely magazines that ran that way. There were definitely like Next Gen was a really tight run ship for the most part.
Yeah.
And they didn't do that. They were close to us by the time I was so when Future started, everybody was in their 20s in the U.S. When Imagine started in the U.S., everybody was in their like late 20s or early 30s. And the alcohol consumption was legendary by the time I started.
Yeah.
And you know, not to glorify that, it wasn't good. It wasn't healthy in a lot of ways, but it was a bunch of like young dudes who were working in San Francisco and like everybody lived together. You know, nobody had girlfriends, nobody had wives. and like the one guy who was married would have everybody over for Thanksgiving and it would turn into like sitting around playing games on the couch and getting really, really blotto. And that was just what they did every day after work too.
Yeah. Yes.
So it's
funny though. I randomly was just chatting with a friend who used to work in that space way back when. Mm-hmm. And they actually said, I had no idea about this. Like they said, there was actually, you know, we talked about the weird adversarial relationship between print and online. It sounds like there was even some factionalism between different magazines because,
oh God, yeah,
this person happened to work on one of those magazines, like you said, where they spread the work out and actually like did it responsibly and you know, got it done without killing themselves. And like, there was a perception from the other side, you know, the other types of magazines that like, oh, well, those guys aren't working 15 hours a day during deadline. What the fuck are they doing? Like, look at these slackers going home at 6 p.m. when they're on deadline. What is this about? Like,
look, that stuff was straight up middle management pitting the magazines against each other. Dude, so people wouldn't talk about how much they were getting paid. I'd be willing
so
to bet.
Dirty. That's so dirty.
It was icky. Anyway.
Yeah. So like the E3 thing, that's the last thing I'll touch on before we go, was like the E3 situation was the ultimate manifestation of this divide.
Yeah.
Because yes, I heard about their E3 experience was they would get, you know, they'd go to the show, take the meetings they had, see the games, do nothing with it because they can't run a magazine with E3 coverage for another month.
I had three pages for E3 every year.
Okay.
I had three pages for Comdex. I had three pages for CES.
Right. And so they would see the stuff at the show, leave the show at 4 or 5 and like go to parties all night. And that was the entire trade show.
Yep.
And we were running around taking meetings all day, running back to the booth, writing stuff up in between meetings. If you had 20 minutes to try to bang a story out and then staying up till like well into the AM, finishing all the other stuff we had to write. Like it was a meat grinder.
Well, it's the difference between like covering everything and covering the five most interesting things, right?
Totally. Yeah.
And covering five most interesting things is way easier than covering everything, it turns out. When we launched MaximumPC.com in 2007, I think again, and like Norm and I were the online team at that point. Like I was running the magazine. I was also running the website and I hired Norm to come in and be like the web guy. And we went to E3. I'd gotten an interview with Carmack the year that I think Rage was coming out, the Rage year probably, which I think was also the Rock Band year, maybe, or Rock Band 2 year.
That might be right. Yeah.
And we went to an interview. We went to interview Carmack in the theater where the Rock Band stuff was happening because they were both EA. And we were backstage and then the PR person was like, hey, do you want to go? The Who's getting ready to play. And I was like, fuck yeah, I want to go watch The Who play. So we went, Norm was like, we got to go transcribe this 45-minute Carmack interview. And I was like, dude, you're right, but I want to go see The Who. He's like, yeah, I want to see The Who too. So we went and saw The Who. And then the moment they left the stage, we busted ass back to the hotel. And like, he took the back half of the recording and I took the front half of the recording. And we transcribed until like 3 o'clock in the morning and posted incredible. This Carmack interview.
That's fantastic.
And I was like, oh God, these online people, this is a horrible way to live. We need like 10 times as many people for this.
Yep.
So yeah, I feel your pain, man.
Yeah. Whatever. I mean, it got me where I am. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Yeah.
As bumpy as it was at times.
The grass is always greener. And if you're ever in a position where like you have institutional hatred of somebody else inside your organization or competitors, maybe think about why people might want that to happen.
That's probably coming from somewhere.
Yeah. That shit doesn't happen by accident, yo.
Yeah.
Like they made us, they had built this relationship with Ziff Davis people that was entirely, the entire goal of that was so that people didn't go work for fucking Ziff Davis and make more money. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, Ziff Davis was publishing PC Mag and a bunch of other games books. Anyway.
Oh. It was a time.
It was a time. speaking of time, this is the time in which we thank the patrons of our show.
Yeah. It's the best time of the show.
Yeah. So if you would like to know how you can support the Tech Pod, you can find out by going to patreon.com/techpod, where you can get access to the fabulous Tech Pod Discord full of wonderful, beautiful nerds who are fonts of information and will enrich your life enrich my life in uncountable ways at this point. As always, thanks to all of our patrons, but a special thanks go to our executive producer tier patrons, The Bunny Fiend, Jacob Chappell, David Allen, and James Kamick. Thank you all so much.
Yeah.
In addition to the fabulous TechPod Discord, you can get access to our exclusive patron only episode, where this month we did like a potpourri episode, kind of, where we like ran down all of the things that we didn't have enough to do a full episode on of the real show, of the regular show.
Yeah. Like your busted water main.
My busted water main. We talked about, I call him Alan, by the way, the busted water main.
Ah, oh yes. Yes. He's a family friend.
Yeah. We talked about Hitman adventures and how we learn Hitman games, stuff like that.
And how those levels work.
God, they're so fucking cool.
It's pretty good. They're pretty good.
Yeah. Pretty good. But that's it. That's it for the month. Oh, hey, if anybody wants Girl Scout cookies, my daughter's selling Girl Scout cookies.
Oh, don't say that.
You can go to cookies.content.town and order.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
And here, the cookie industry is part of the fabulous TechPod empire, the Content Town empire.
Oh, my God. I can't believe I'm looking at this right now. Oh, no. What is a trefoil? What in the world?
It's shortbread. It's the Girl Scout shortbread cookie. They're pretty good. They melt in your mouth.
Okay.
But
hang
just
on.
So you know, there's two Girl Scout bakeries. One makes caramel delights and peanut butter patties. That one sucks. That's not where we are.
Okay.
We're firmly in Samoa / tagalong territory here.
Oh, no. They do s'mores now?
S'mores, you know, the secret of the s'mores, you put in the microwave oven for 5 seconds and the marshmallow bit gets kind of melty and it's delicious.
No offense to your child, but I'm closing this window.
Yeah, no, it's if you don't want to get cookies and you still want to support the Girl Scouts, then you can donate boxes to soldiers abroad. They send the Girl Scouts send care packages with cookies to people who are stationed overseas, which I think is awesome.
That is a much more honorable and less destructive use of your money.
There you go.
Where Girl Scout cookies are concerned.
Patreon.com/techpod. Thank you all for supporting the show. We will be back next week.